It's good to see you today. My name is Josh Cook. It's really an honor and privilege to be able to meet you all and see you again. I have visited this congregation before when we've been down here, but this is my first time being able to speak and teach, and I'm happy to be here. I'm glad that we can all be assembled together shortly to worship, and I hope today's Bible class is profitable. We're going to be studying from the book of Haggai. It's a short little book. Most Bible students may admit that they haven't given it a serious study, and so I have taken that opportunity to go ahead and use it for a one-time Bible class. It's very compact and concise, so we can usually get through most of the material in one Bible class. And so you can say, after this class, you studied a whole book of the Bible. All right, so Haggai, I'd like us to read as we go. We'll kind of break it up into sections, but it's all short. Let me give you some background information about it. Haggai is a prophet contemporary with Zechariah. Both were prophets of the Lord after the exile. So when they all come back from Babylonian exile, these two prophets, among others, but these two in particular, really had one main message, and that was, we need to rebuild the temple. You'll remember in 586, the last invasion of Nebuchadnezzar razed the city of Jerusalem to the ground. And it left the temple in ruins. It was burned, and artifacts were taken, dismantled, never to return. And so now they have the task of rebuilding this temple, and that's the context. Other books that would really help in understanding what's happening at this time, the post-exilic books, the ones that come after the exile, are Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. They are Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther. And it's 1 Chronicles, the genealogies, and 2 Chronicles, the last chapter. So those are the books that help us understand what's happening at this time. Okay, so let's go ahead and let's read the first. Let's go ahead and read the first six verses. And who would like to read? We'll just take volunteers as we go. Clay? Or Cal. It's Cal, not Clay. Cal.
Cal, that's great. Take six verses?
Yes, sir.
In the second year of Darius the king, in the sixth month, in the first day of the month, came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet unto Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Josedech, the high priest, saying, thus speaketh the Lord of hosts, saying, this people say, the time is not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. Then came by the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet, saying, is it time for you, O ye, to dwell in your good houses, and this house lie waste? Now therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. You have sown much, and bring in little, but ye have not enough. Ye drink, but ye are not filled with drink. Ye clothe you, but there is none warm. And he that earneth wages to put in a bag with holes.
Okay, thank you. All right, so the people have come back in many waves, and this is the group that has come back in the first wave. They actually, according to the book of Ezra, started to lay the foundation. And then they got stopped by some of their adversaries in that region who wrote a letter through Rehum the commander and Shimshai the scribe. They sent a letter to the king of Persia at that time. And so they had to cease for 16 years. So they started it in 536. That's when they got the foundation started to lay it. And then they didn't resume work until the 20s, 520. The book of Haggai is unique in that no other prophetic book has the density of dated material. There are no less than 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 dates specific. And they're all addressed and in reference to a king other than Israel, which is unique for the post-exile time. When they came back from exile, they didn't have a king anymore in Israel. So when they started referencing time, it was to the leader of their world, which happened to be in the Persian Empire. So because it's dated, it's real. It has more of a sense of it's real, it's grounded, it can be verified. You can go check. The Bible's not afraid to place itself within history because it is real and it is part of history. It's not parallel to it in some fictional fashion. Okay, so let's look at a brief review of the book in case I can't get all the way through, and then we'll start dissecting it in its parts. So what's going to happen here? Haggai, by the way, was a very convincing and successful prophet. And if you think on the history of prophets in Israel, they didn't always have a good track record with the people. It wasn't their fault. It's just the people usually weren't as receptive as they should have been. Not so with Haggai. He had some inroads. In chapter 1, the people are going to admit to Haggai, the time has not come yet. We're not ready to build this house. And Haggai is going to come back and reject that with specific arguments. And after this, the people give their response in a positive fashion. They agree that their reasons for not doing it up until this point were pretty shabby. And so they are now wholeheartedly going to move towards building the temple. And if you look at the time, verse 1, the date corresponds to August 29th, 520 BC. And by the end of chapter 1, verse 15, you have September 21st. In 23 days, the prophet was able to reverse this people's thinking. And I've heard of tent meetings that have gone on for about that long, and entire congregations have sprung up into existence from those old-time tent meetings. I know the congregation I used to preach in Yorkville, they had that same experience. It was about 20 to 25 days. I can't remember right off the top of my head, but they had a tent meeting that lasted that long, and the product of that was the congregation itself in that area. So, pretty good track record for Haggai, but what made it work, in the words of Alan Hires, what made it work was a thus saith the Lord. The reason it worked was not because Haggai was some phenomenal preacher or teacher. He just kept saying, thus says the Lord on this, and they responded to that. And anything that works for good in this world responds to a thus saith the Lord. Okay, so they respond well. They say, we're going to do this, and they're stirred up. They're ready to go. That's chapter 1. Chapter 2, we already hit our first hiccup. They're ready to go in mind and in spirit. But when it comes time to doing the work, laying their hands on it, they get a little shaky. They get a little apprehensive. And so Haggai tries to appeal to them as one of them and says, yeah, I know this place is not looking like it used to look. I know this is not the former glory, but we've got to do this. And then he appeals to the language that we're familiar with when the first temple was built. Do you recall what David spoke to Solomon when the first temple was being built? Be strong, courageous. There's actually a song, be strong and courageous and do not be afraid. That's the language here that's used again to try to invigorate this people as they're going to rebuild it again. I believe that's from 1 Chronicles chapter 28, verse 20. All right, so the people are encouraged by Haggai, by the word of the Lord, that he's going to be with them. And as you read through chapter 2, chapter 2 begins and it's a second oracle. It's a second message, okay? And it's meant to get the people back on track. And it seems to work. And that same chapter has another two messages, and they all occur on the same date. Verse 10 and verse 20 are the same day. So everything from 10 through the rest of the chapter in chapter 2 is on one day, but it's two different messages. The first one is more towards the priest. And I think we would assume Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, would be in that audience. And the second one is to Zerubbabel. Now, Zerubbabel is a descendant of who? Shealtiel. And we can read about his lineage in, I believe it's 1 Chronicles 3:19. You can read about Shealtiel and his brothers and his father. But ultimately, if you trace it back up, who does it go to? He's a governor. He's a leader, a civil leader. He's actually a descendant of David. And Zerubbabel is in the line of Jesus as well. Okay, and so that last message is directed to him. All right, so chapter 1, you have this temple project that Haggai is trying to push for the Lord. But the popular consensus is the time's not yet come. And why hasn't the time yet come to build the house of the Lord? Well, their argument is, we don't have anything for ourselves. Look at what's happening. We sow much, but we harvest little. We eat, but we never have enough. We drink, but we never get our fill. We clothe ourselves, but no one's warm. And we earn wages just to put them into a bag with holes. So they feel like they're just trying to scrape by themselves. Who can focus on the temple when I feel like I'm not even getting what I need out of this economy? Who can focus on the work of the Lord when I'm just scrapping by? Okay, but there's a connection here. There's a reason why they are struggling so much, and it has everything to do with the fact that the house is lying in ruins. It's interesting that in verse 4 of chapter 1, Haggai says, "Is it a time for you yourselves to dwell in your paneled houses?" The English Standard Version has. Paneled houses, what is that? It's a dwelling unit that's been upgraded. They had their basic dwelling units, but then they started to upgrade them. Meanwhile, what's going on over here with the temple? There's nothing. It's just, there's maybe a part of a foundation there. And they had an altar built because they were doing sacrifices, but where's the temple? And here they are just trying to build up my paneled house. And he's making the contrast, while this house lies in ruins. Haggai specifically uses the word house instead of the technical word temple, because he wants to connect that idea. Look at your house, look at the Lord's house. We have a problem here. And the reason there's a problem is because of their lack of zeal and vigor to get on that project. So in verse 7 it says, "Thus says the Lord of hosts, consider your ways." He's telling them, go get what it takes to accomplish this. And he says at the end of verse 9, because of my house that lies in ruins, he's about to make a play on words in verses 9 and 11. Because of my house that lies in ruins, while each of you busies himself with his own house, therefore the heavens above you have withheld the dew, and the earth has withheld its produce, and I have called for a drought on the land. I want to stop there and focus on the word drought in verse 11, and then back up to verse 9, the fact that the house lies in ruins. Lies in ruins is a cognate verb to this word drought. It's like believe, which is a verb, and belief, which is a noun. If you were Hebrew and you were reading this, the lies in ruins and drought would look very similar. One was a verb, one was a noun. So he's saying my house, and the word this lies in ruins can be defined as dried up, no water or vegetation, desolate. Because my house is desolate, I have called for desolation on the land that you inhabit. You're struggling to make by because I have deemed it so, because my house is in ruins. And the vicious cycle about this is that they're seeing their problem of the economy unfold before them, and what do they try to do to get out of it? Do they work towards building the house, or what do? They focus on themselves even more. Well, this economy is getting rough. I think I need to focus on myself more. Of course, the Lord is saying, look, that very attitude is what brought you into that situation. And to get out of it, we've got to turn our attention back to God. And so, well, can that explain this economy? I don't know. I'm not going to say that it does. But any time a people have rejected God, they've suffered. There's no doubt about that. Okay, so he gets their attention. And in verse 12, there is a very encouraging response. And you'll notice throughout this book, Zerubbabel, the civil leader, and Joshua, the religious leader, the high priest, they are constantly being addressed. Why do you think that is? Why do you think Haggai, I mean, he includes the people, but why always in letter form, in written form, includes Zerubbabel and Joshua? What happens if you get your leaders on board? Everybody else follows. You get the leaders, you can get the rest. So you got to get the leaders. Don't just get the rest and your leadership is going the wrong way. You got to get the leaders on board. And so he strives to do that with giving them specific address in each of these messages. Okay? And then the remnant of the people. Well, that's the people that were left over. That's the people who endured through captivity, who made it through that catastrophe, and who have agreed to obey the Lord. That's what the remnant of the people stands for. It's also called people of the land in chapter 2, verse 4. It's a reference to those who are left and those who are obedient specifically. All right, and then as you read through, let's see, we left off at verse 6. Let's read verses 7 through 11. I've referenced some of that, but let's read the text actually, and then we'll make a couple more comments. Who would like to read 7 through 11? Okay, Brother Voss.
Thus saith the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. Go up to the mountains and bring wood and build a house, and I will lay there in it, and I will fortify it, saith the Lord. He looked for much, and lo, it came to look. And when he brought it home, hold it upon it. All right. Why, saith the Lord of hosts, because of mine house that is waste, and ye run every man under his own house. Therefore the heaven over you is stayed from dew, and the earth is stayed from fall for a drought upon the land, the oil, and upon that hand, and upon the cattle, all the labor.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, according to 1 Kings chapter 8, verse 27, it was Solomon who said, but will God indeed dwell on the earth? Behold, heaven and the highest heaven cannot contain you. How much less this house that I have built? The Israelites knew God could not be encapsulated in the temple. But we note here, from Haggai, the reason why God wants his temple. What does it say in verse 8? It can't contain him, but it glorifies him. He takes pleasure in the fact that there is the temple there. And remember, Israel at this time has been jumbled up. They need to get back to normative Israelite life. And the central epicenter of that was what? It was the temple. They had their altar, and maybe they thought that was enough. And that's why maybe they were slow about getting the rest of it built. But it was a dwelling place for the Lord. It was how they interacted with God. So basically they were saying, God, we don't really need you right now. We're doing okay. We're doing just fine. What's that?
Are we saying the same? Are we not supposed to rebuild the temple? Are we not to go therefore into all the world to teach every creature and bring them to God?
It's an excellent application, I think, for the church today. The church today is the dwelling place of the Lord. You know, every time you talk about the building analogy for the church, think about the references. Living stones. Build up. It's a continuous action. It's something that is not yet... You see, the temple had exact measurements. And when you achieved those exact measurements in physical space and time, you had a constructed temple. Not so with the church. It is ever moving, ever growing. In our generation, it is unbuilt. because there are more to be a part of it. And in that sense, it does apply to us. That if we lose sight of constructing the temple, I'm not talking about going around building church buildings. We're talking about incorporating the living stones into the kingdom.
Not just the organization, not just the organized going out as groups and talking to people, but in our everyday actions as we're walking and talking.
Right.
Show people the kindness and generosity which is supposed to be in it.
Right.
And that generosity is right here.
Yeah. Yeah, those are great points. That's right in line with, I think, what they were struggling with in a physical sense. We have to overcome that in a spiritual sense as well. Mm-hmm. Any other comments or questions so far about chapter 1?
I think about David was to build the temple. Even in war, you cannot build my temple.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. They're not even wanting to, where David was so passionate to try to do it. Night and day. We're going to get into probably a good explanation of why they have that attitude coming up in chapter 2. Any other comments or questions about chapter 1? Anything puzzling?
Well, in the Old Testament, of course, we're looking at a long span of time, old in their disobedience, and we criticize that oftentimes.
Right.
But we can just look back. We had the problem with orphan homes and everything that come down the pipe. So.
Right.
In essence, we have a lot in common, don't we?
Yeah. It's easy to point fingers when you're on this side of the issue, and you can look back on it. That's like saying, well, if I was one of those apostles, I wouldn't have abandoned Jesus. Well, if you didn't know what happened all the way through, you really can't say that. So, yeah, what are we going to look on 10 years, 20 years from now and say, boy, we could have done that better? Or why didn't we see that a little quicker? Yeah, I think we arrive at that point when we fail to keep this locked in. If we stray from this, we're always going to have some error that needs to be corrected. Okay, any other comments or questions? Chapter 1. All right, let's the people's response is in verses 12 through 15. Let's read that, and then we'll talk about chapter 2. Who would like to read verses 12 through 15? That was verse 11. Let's just read 12 through 15 now.
Okay.
Zerubbabel.
Then Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Josedech, the high priest, with all the remnant of the people, obeyed the voice of the Lord, their God, and the words of Haggai the prophet, as the Lord, their God, had sent him for the Lord. Then spake Haggai, the Lord messenger, saith the Lord. And the Lord stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, the governor of Judah, and the spirit of Joshua, the son of Josedech, high priest, and the spirit of the remnant of the people. They came and did work in the house of the Lord, a host, their God, in the fourth and 20th day of the sixth month, thereof, Darius the king.
Very good, thank you. And again, we note that's just 23 days later from when Haggai first confronted them about their delay in building the house. So that's a good turnaround for a prophet. And remember, it was because he spoke for the Lord. It wasn't just him. Now look at this word fear in verse 12 at the end of it. And the people feared the Lord. Sometimes in the New Testament, when you look at fear, it needs to be explained that that is a divine reverence. But in this case, it is not. This is the word for terror of the wrath of God. They actually feared God's wrath in this case. They didn't just have a reverence for Him. They were fearful of Him. And that's why it's so important that He follows up with, I am with you. declares the Lord. They needed the reassurance at that point. Because Haggai was basically saying, God's not happy with you. And I think they genuinely just thought, oh, wow, we became ignorant. We became lax. And now we got to make it right. And does that happen? Is it all malicious when you go from the Lord? It's not always malicious. It's not always, I am out to get away from God and Jesus and everything He stands for. Sometimes it's just a slow creep. And that's the worst, isn't it?
It would suddenly be the devil.
Yeah, it'd be better if we just got up and turn around aggressively for a specific reason than just slip back and still believe we're on stable ground. That's very dangerous. And the people are, that's why it says, and the spirit of Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and the spirit of all the remnant of the people, it says that the Lord stirred them up in the spirit of Zerubbabel. And that word stirred has to do with the idea of awakening. They were asleep. And they're being stirred up. Now, how are they being stirred up? It says the Lord stirred them up, but back up to verse 13. How's the Lord stirring them? It's provided right there for us. It's not some feeling. The Word convicts, and it converts, and it changes a person. And so that's what's being done here. That has the ability to awaken somebody. That has the ability to bring life where there's death and reason where there is no reason. And so that's the impetus here. Okay? And let's go on and read chapter 2. Any comments or questions? All right, let's read chapter 2, verses 1 through 9. Who would like to read that? All right, Vance.
Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the people, who is left among you that sword? How do you now? Is it not in your eyes in comparison of it as nothing? Yet now be strong, saith the Lord, and be strong, Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest. Be all ye people of the land. I am with you, saith the word that I covenant with you. Though my spirit remaineth among you, fear ye not. This saith the Lord of hosts, yet once it is a while, and I will shake the heavens and the earth and the dry land, and I will show where is mine and gold is mine, saith the glory of this latter house shall be greater than of the former, saith the Lord of hosts.
Thank you. Now, just for reference, the date here at the beginning of chapter 2, verse 1, is October 17th, 520 B.C. And in verse 10... it's December 18th, 520 B.C. And between verse 9 and verse 10 is when Zechariah chapter 1, when Zechariah delivers his first message. And so if you look at the dates in Zechariah 1, that's where you see that he indeed is a contemporary of Haggai. And Ezra chapter 5 mentions them as being as working together, both focused on getting the temple rebuilt. So it's not just Haggai. Zechariah is very much a part of this. But here they are, 2 months after the first message in 1:1, and they're already getting discouraged. And so he needs to bring them some consolation. He needs to try to keep them to the task. And so he identifies their leaders again, and then uses the thrice repeated imperative, be strong, be strong, be strong, and identifies Zerubbabel, Joshua, and the people of the land, the remnant. Okay? And I mentioned that that's very much like what David told Solomon. And, you got to think about these people for a moment. And by the way, as we keep reading, verse 5 even mentions Egypt and the Exodus. So these things they're familiar with in their history. The language of be strong. Oh, wait, my mommy, she was teaching me that when I was little. That's what David told Solomon. Or the coming out of Egypt. Wait, that was Moses. That was our great ancestors. They were coming out of bondage, and they all knew those stories. But that was like the glory days. And we are just a dismal reflection of what they used to be. And so for Haggai to use this kind of language was connecting the idea, no, you are still that Israel. I know you don't feel like it's like, even Even look at verse 3. Who is left among you, Haggai writes, who saw this house in its former glory? When you look at Ezra chapter 3, verse 12, that's when they actually accomplished getting the whatever part or fraction of the foundation, they had it laid. And in Ezra 3:12, it says that the young men were shouting for joy. Yeah, look at what we've done. We're starting to rebuild it. But the old men wept. Well, if we borrow Haggai and Ezra and try to help one to explain the other, Haggai's question, who is left among you who saw this house in its former glory? How do you see it now? It is as nothing in your eyes. Those old men may have been weeping because they were thinking, this is never going to look like the old one. Well, yeah, we're just not going to be able to do it. What do we say about people? Usually older folks. I say it about older folks. I don't know anybody in my generation that I would say this about, but I usually will think of a person that I really respect who has these qualities that I don't feel like I'm ever going to have, and I'll just say, well, they broke the mold when they made you. It was almost like they idolized these past ancestors of their history and raised them up to levels they shouldn't have been because they all are not coming to grips with the new project that they're supposed to do in the right attitude. They're struggling here. They're struggling to see the purpose of it all. Because as they're doing this, are not their enemies all around them? Their enemies are all around them. And they're plotting against them. Do you remember decades later, after this point, when the wall is being built? In Nehemiah chapter 4, verses 17 through 18, it talks about how with one hand they're building the wall and with the other to do what? They're defending themselves, okay? The same people that were doing that in the time of Nehemiah, it's their ancestors now who are creating problems for Haggai. Okay, every movie I've ever seen which has anything to do with the military, when a unit drops into a new area or an area they've never been for a while, like when the people of Israel come back, what's the captain, the leader of the group, they land and what's the first thing they say to do?
Set a perimeter.
Set a perimeter. Well, they come back and the first thing they're supposed to do is work on the temple. Only God would devise a way of making His people, every other nation in the history of civilization would have secured their perimeter before doing anything like that. Only the people of Israel would have gone in and built that first and then worked on the wall second. In Zechariah chapter 2, verse 5, why could they take that approach? According to Zechariah 2, verse 5. First of all, it was in the Edict of Toleration. We got to give the historical credit. It was the Persian emperor who overthrew the Babylonians who said, go back and rebuild your religious buildings. And they were delayed on their walls. But if we see the works of the world leaders as being an extension of God's hand, which I believe it is, why go and work on a temple before securing your defense? Why would you do that? According to Zechariah, what's the rationale? Why would you do that? That's right. It's counterintuitive if there is no God to walk into a place and start with the temple. But because there is a God of heaven, a people will do that because they can be so convinced. Am I out of time? Are we? One more bell. Okay. Let's see. Any questions or comments so far? We won't try to rush this. We'll just tackle what we were able to tackle.
I just wanted to say, evidently they have finally realized that the Lord indeed of His Spirit was among them.
Yeah.
Verse 5.
That's right. Okay, we're in 520. That's when they restart the project. They finished by 16. So they got the temple built in 5 years, 4 years. It's 516 or 515. And remember, 586 is when the city, the temple, was destroyed. Do the math. 586 minus 516, what do you get? Is that significant? Is 70 years significant? Does that ring a bell? That's right. They actually started taking them before then and releasing them before they finished the temple. But it seems like the destruction of the temple and the building of the temple marks that 70 years mentioned in Jeremiah 29. That seems to be what the Lord had in mind with the 70 years captivity. If you were part of the first wave to come into captivity and a part of the last wave to come out, then it was longer. But that seems to be the 70 years that's being referenced. Any other comments or questions? All right. Let's talk about this shaking. Verse 6, I will shake the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land. That's called the double merism. Merism is talking about a totality from contrasting parts. So in this case, it's raised to the power of two. And that just simply means God will use everything at His disposal, which is everything, to accomplish this work that He's going to set out to do. So He's going to shake the nations, it says, and so that the treasures or desire of all nations shall come in. Okay? Depending on your translation, I don't know what it reads there. I think King James Version says desire of all nations. Is that right? And then, the shall come in is actually plural. So the verb is plural, which if it's desire, it's got to be a collective thing. It's got to be more than one. Sometimes this verse has been used to speak about the messianic prophecy. But the desire has to be plural. And so Jesus isn't plural. It makes more sense to think about this as material treasures that were used to actually physically build the temple. That may be a way we explain that. I guess that's the second bill.
Your time's up.
Time's up, so we'll just stop there.